So 2,200 years ago, a Jewish mother watched in horror as her seven sons were each given a choice between brutal death and the chance to offer a sacrifice to a pagan deity. Well, one by one, each of those sons chose faithfulness to God and endured suffering so cruel it couldn't even be shown in the most disgusting of gory films today. In 1944, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German church leader and theologian, chose a path of resistance to Nazism, which led to his violent death at the hands of the regime. In 1968, deep behind the atheist Iron Curtain, the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt appeared on state radio, where he calmly explained that the greatest influence on his music was his devotion to Jesus Christ. Well, the awkward silence that followed turned into an official ban on his works being performed until the end of communism. The question is, why were people like this so willing to be brave? Now, one thing all these people had in common was they had all read the book of Daniel. And in it, like us, if we've been here for the last few months, they would have read about Daniel in the lion's den being miraculously saved at the last moment. They'd have read of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, not alone, but saved by God. And so were they expecting to be saved, I wonder? Were they expecting a deliverance to come at the final moment? Well, let me tell you that they didn't expect that, as they acted bravely, because they had read the rest of the book of Daniel, as we are going to today, and they knew what we're about to discover, that things don't always turn out well when we act bravely and do what is right. Things won't always turn out well, but they will end well. They will end well. Those are the messages from Daniel chapter 7 that we're going to come across this morning. Things won't always turn out well when you do the right thing, but they will end well. Well, that was a weird reading, wasn't it? Very, very strange, with all sorts of creatures, visions of creatures coming out of the sea and doing violent things, eating people, trampling them down. And it's very hard for us to hear that and say at the end of it, this is the word of the Lord, thanks be to God. Because you might be thinking, well, that was the strangest thing I've ever heard. This is a type of writing that's not very familiar to us in the 21st century West. It's a type of writing called apocalyptic. And apocalyptic is often compared to impressionist painting. You know, if you went to look at a Monet masterpiece, you looked at it in great detail, it wouldn't make any sense, would it? A load of splodges of oil on canvas, and you think, what on earth is that meant to be? But as you take a step back, and take another step back, and another step back, what looks like nonsense becomes something of great beauty. In fact, it's interesting, isn't it, how the impressionist painters are often able to depict something more accurately than realist painters. You look at water in impressionist painting, it just somehow looks wetter than normal water. It's more real. Sometimes that non-realist way of showing things is more precise. And that's what the authors of apocalyptic writings like this wanted to get across to us, a symbolic message. And the message to Daniel is the message to us that for hundreds of years, from Belshazzar's reign onwards, when the vision was first received, there would be violence and people won't escape it. Things won't turn out well for God's people. For the next few hundred years, life is going to be tough. As one violent ruler, one beastly regime after another, oppresses the people of God. Now, experts are divided about which beast represents which empire. We've got the Babylonian Empire and the Medes and the Persians and the Greek Empire. And it's a bit hard to work out then what the final beast, the one Daniel's really interested in, refers to. He says this: after I saw the visions by night, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong, appeared. It had great iron teeth and was devouring breaking in pieces and stamping what was left with its feet. So the difference here is that whereas people escaped, some people escaped the previous beasts, those who aren't eaten by the beast are going to be stamped on by this beast. It was different from all the beasts that preceded it. It had 10 horns. Horns in this type of writing are a symbol of power and violence. I was considering the horn, says Daniel, when another horn appeared. It was a little one. To make room for it, three of the other horns were supplanted. And on that horn, it wasn't strange enough, by the way, human eyes and a mouth speaking arrogantly. What is that little horn, that boastful, arrogant, violent person? Who is that? Again, scholars divide exactly who it is, but the message is clear that God's people should expect things not to turn out well. That was true in Daniel's day and perhaps true for us today. The most likely person is a guy called Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who was a king in the 2nd century BC, who did great harm to God's people. Don't know how much you know about ancient history, but you remember that Alexander the Great conquered a huge empire all the way from Macedonia down to Egypt and through to India. When he died, his empire was split into four ways by the four generals who fought for power after him, fought to be his successor. One of those chunks went all the way from Jerusalem to India and down to the border of Egypt, where there was another empire. And this empire, which Jerusalem was in, was called the Seleucid Empire. And one of their kings was called Antiochus Epiphanes. He was an arrogant, small, and cruel man. All sorts of things that fit the description of the little boastful horn doing such violence. He was arrogant. His nickname that he gave himself, I don't know if you've got a nickname or whether you introduce yourself to other people with the nickname. Yeah, well, the name's Philip, but most people call me the coolest man in the world. It's obvious that that nickname is made up by Philip himself. Well, Antiochus's nickname that he gave himself was Epiphanes, which means manifest gods. That's a great name, isn't it? Manifest gods. Gods in the flesh. God standing right before you where you can see. That's the nickname Antiochus gave himself. He was a small and cowardly man. There's a great story that illustrates this. One day he was making his way with his army to go and attack Egypt. And on the road to Egypt, which had just allied itself to the Roman Republic, an elderly Roman ambassador came out to meet them. And his name was Gaius Popilius Lianus, and he stood there in the road in front of this vast army with its cavalry and its siege engines and the emperor Antiochus himself. He stood there alone on the road and said, if you pass a step further, you will be at war with the Roman Republic. And he went a step further. He went up to Antiochus and drew a circle in the sand around the emperor and said, if you step outside of this circle without having surrendered, there will be war between us. Well, Antiochus made his apologies and slunk off home. He was arrogant, he was a small man, a cowardly man, and he was a cruel man. During his reign, he persecuted the Jews without mercy. All of this is recorded in some books of the Apocrypha, some early Jewish books, the 1 and 2 Maccabees that describe this. Those seven sons of a Jewish mother who were given the choice between making a sacrifice to Zeus or sticking with faithfulness to the God of their ancestors, the bully, the torturer, there was Antiochus himself. This is a man who showed no mercy, who was utterly set upon the eradication of God's people. He wouldn't be the first and he wouldn't be the last. And the message is clear. Things won't always turn out well. When you do what is right, when you do what is brave, when you act like Daniel and say the right thing, when you make a choice for bravery and truth and justice, things won't always work out well for you. things won't always work out well for you. That's true in a very general sense. Sickness may lead to death in this life. Bravery may lead to a loss of friends or even work. Divine intervention, God directly intervening, is possible, but it's not promised. It's possible, but it's not promised. It shouldn't be our expectation. That means that we can't be angry with God if he doesn't rock up and save the day. That means you can't be angry with God if things don't turn out well. It's a possibility, but it's not a promise. Just like you can't be angry with me if there's no sherry after the service. Because the thing is, I've never promised you that there would be sherry after the service. Now, it is possible. I do own sherry, and I have the financial means to buy sherry, and I quite like you, and I quite like sherry. So I might provide you with sherry, in theory. But the thing is, it's not what I think we've gathered here this morning for. Gathered together to hear the word of God and to pray to God and to encourage each other not to drink sherry. So it's possible, but it's not promised. In the same way, God doesn't promise us that things will always work out well when we get into difficulty, because that's not why we're here. That's not why we're here. Things won't always turn out well, but like Daniel, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the book of Daniel, we should still act bravely. Why? Because even though things won't turn out well, they will end well. They will end well. That's the message of Daniel chapter 7. Something is going on behind the scenes that Antiochus Epiphanes, the bully, the tyrant, the persecutor of God's people, cannot see, and nor can any other persecutor of God's people since have seen. Verse 9, as I watched, thrones were set in place, and an ancient one took his throne. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. This is a vision of the throne room of God. His throne was fiery flames, and his wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and flowed out from his presence. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood attending him. What is God going to do? The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. The books containing all the deeds of Antiochus, all the deeds of those who bravely stood up for what is right and what is good. And judgment is about to happen. On Friday nights in our family film night, we watched the fantastic film, which I don't think I'd ever seen before, the 80s classic, The Karate Kids. Have you seen that film? It is absolutely brilliant. One of my favourite scenes from that was that the protagonist, our little hero, the Karate Kid, is being chased by some bullies, and just outside his apartment block is being beaten up mercilessly. And the focus of the camera, the bit that's kind of clear that you can make out really nicely, is him being beaten up. That's what's going on, as far as we can tell. But there is a fence behind. And in the background, a bit sort of blurry, a bit hazy, over the fence climbs Mr. Miyagi. Now, Mr. Miyagi is the mild-mannered janitor, maintenance man of the apartment block. But we just know there's something else about Mr. Miyagi that we should know. As he climbs over the fence, it's getting ever so exciting, because judgment is about to happen. Justice is about to take place. And sure enough, as Mr. Miyagi reveals his karate expertise, as the bullies are beaten up and chased away, justice is being done. Something which the bullies, the violent persecutors, can't see is going on behind the scenes. It's like the villain in a pantomime strutting around the stage, boasting about their victory, not knowing that their comeuppance is right behind them. It's behind you, we want to shout, but actually we'd rather watch justice unfold. Well, that's certainly Daniel's experience. I watched then because of the noise of the arrogant words that the horn was speaking, waiting for justice to take place. Things are going to end well. Justice is done. Behind the suffering, whatever suffering that you experience, whatever worry, whatever fear may be dominating your life at the moment, God is on his throne and he's given power to one who is like a son of man. I saw one like a human being. If you've got your church Bible there, you see a little footnote, B, saying like a son of man, which is the traditional non-politically correct translation, which actually is miles more accurate in this case. One like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the ancient one, the ancient of days, God himself, and was given dominion, glory, and kingship so that all peoples, nations, and languages would serve him. And his dominion is everlasting, his power won't pass away, and his kingship is one that will never be destroyed. This is what is going on behind the scenes, behind the suffering, which means that even if things don't turn out well for you in the here and now, they will end well. The Son of Man has been given power over everything, and his reign is never going to stop. He's going to rule over God's creation forever. And there's no one that this doesn't apply to. Every tribe, language, and tongue are for the Son of Man, this King who's coming. Do you know how Jesus referred to himself? Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. He said about himself, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. He said about himself, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And when he called himself the Son of Man, it wasn't just a coincidence. Jesus was picking up of the promise made in Daniel chapter 7 that one day a king would come who would reign over everything forever, meaning that things will end well. Things will end well for those who trust in the Son of Man, that rescuer king, who though he holds all power in heaven and on earth in his hands, chooses to lay that aside, to give his life as a ransom for many. Things won't always turn out well. Who knows what the future is going to hold with coronavirus. That's one of the most helpful things the Prime Minister said last week. It's the kind of thing that politicians don't usually say. A moment of brutal honesty is that some of us, some of those we love, are going to die as a result of this sickness. We shouldn't live life as though a miracle is around the corner. That's not promised and it shouldn't be expected. And so we should take our health and the health of others seriously at this time. It's easy to scoff at all the stuff that we're trying to do at the moment. We're just trying to do the right thing and follow the best advice. I hope we can all see that. Things won't always work out well. But there is a person who died and rose again to destroy the power of death. The thing that we fear the most, the thing we're trying to save ourselves from when we rob the supermarkets of the toilet roll and steal hand sanitizer from the hospitals, trying desperately to cling on to life. Well, there's only one person who can give us life in all its fullness, and he died and rose again to give that to us, and that is the Son of Man, who gave his life as a ransom for many, Jesus Christ. And it's him we worship today, and it's him we follow as we seek to live lives of great bravery for him. Amen.